Get ready for the Ocelli effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck Ocelli, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassination, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you, and everybody at AFR I know loves you, man.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media. The alternative, Chuck Ocelli.
It is the second day of June 2017, allegedly according to that thing we call a calendar, and yes, indeed, this is the Ocelli Effect, broadcast live from the facilities of AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We do welcome you no matter how you have encountered the show, by your fondle slab of choice, your applicable application, etc. Now, I dispense with all of that rather quickly. No commentary from yours truly tonight because we only have 1 hour with a guest that I'm extremely happy to have with us. Why is that? Well, I could take up the entire hour giving you his resume. seriously, all of the articles that have been written, the books that have been written, the diverse topics, obviously, we could sit and have a JFK assassination-related show, and you guys know I would be more than happy to do that, with author Dick Russell. However, that is not going to be the focus. Maybe we'll squeeze in some questions toward the end of tonight's interaction, and I do hope this is not the only time that we have Dick Russell on the show, because I am a fan of his writing. I mentioned him several times. Obviously, this is the guy who has written The Man Who Knew Too Much, which is a study of Richard Case Nagel. Now, I'm doing this from memory, by the way. I am not going to attempt to read his full resume on air. But look, The Man Who Knew Too Much, which is all about Richard Case Nagel, interesting figure, a book that gets confused along with one of Garrison's books, would be On the Trail of the JFK Assassins. Now, this does look similar to one of Garrison's titles. However, it is a collection of shorter pieces together. And one of the most interesting ones, if you pick up that book, is all about this guy named Popkins and the crazy things that he did. Anyway, you got to read it to figure it out. The thing is, there is that. There is the fact that he is the listed co-author with Jesse Ventura on multiple books. Okay, American Conspiracy, 63 documents that the government doesn't want you to read, et cetera, et cetera. And, probably the most unkind thing I probably ever said about this author is that really he probably did most of the work in some of those books. But that's my opinion. Okay, not asking that question of Mr. Russell tonight. Anyway, enough of all of what I've got to say. We are here tonight to discuss a newer book of his, which has a title that makes me a bit nervous. Although it is familiar subject matter for you guys. Check this out. Horsemen of the Apocalypse, The Men Who Are Destroying Life on Earth, and What It Means for Our Children. Now, this is, I know there are contributions in there by RFK Jr. I think he's a listed co-author. I think I saw David Talbot mentioned on the cover of this book. Full disclosure, I have not read this piece of work by Dick Russell, but I want to find out what it's about, and I guarantee you I'm going to wind up getting a hold of a copy at some point, and it'll probably end up in our suggested reading, as some of the other works by Mr. Russell have over at Ocelli.com. Now, I know that was long and winded there, Dick, but first of all, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, Chuck. Very good to be with you. Thanks for that laudatory introduction, probably more than I deserve. Thank you.
Well, I didn't even squeeze in everything. I mean, we could talk about your time as a writer at the Village Voice. We could talk about, some of the other interesting presentations you've done. Like I said, mentioning you with John Barber. I mean, I've had more than one author tell me that you were inspirationally at least behind some of their work. I think Joe Hickman is a guy actually, who's been on this show. Do you know Joe Hickman, right?
Yeah, I do. Joe's a great guy. He was a security guard there at Guantanamo and learned a lot of things that he's been willing to go public with. So, I have a lot of respect for him.
Oh, yeah. And we talked about, I do believe it was his book on burn pits that we discussed on this show. But your name came up, right? Yeah. And like I said, with John Barber, with all these different people, Because you did that presentation in Las Vegas with John a couple of years back. So we promoted that on this show. And also promoted the DVD afterwards. And I thought it was fascinating that you were there, actually. You know, it's kind of makes sense that Joan Mellon would be there because of her focus on Garrison and all that. But anyway, I do digress because this is a frightening kind of, title that is on the front of this book. Usually not something you do. So let's get a sense, you know, without giving it away, what is in this book? I mean, it's obviously not science fiction. And again, the involvement of RFK Jr., who has been very public about, well, some of the weaponization of certain things against people on the planet. I can see where this might be going, but how about you tell us, you know, what the inspiration for this book is and what the general idea is. Cause again, I already know I'm going to get a hold of a copy, but I want to give people who are listening an idea of why they need to get a hold of a copy of this book.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you know, Horsemen of the Apocalypse is unfortunately a very real title because the book is about the big moguls, the energy titans of this country who are still pumping fossil fuels into the atmosphere, who are the most responsible and have covered up, in many cases, what's going on with climate change. And, you know, we're talking about a threat to human civilization that is unlike anything we've ever witnessed. And I got into this subject. I was writing about global warming back in the late 1980s, so I was one of the early journalists to look at it. And I was a strong environmentalist then and remain so today, in terms of one of the focuses of my work. And so I've been exposing what I could through the years, and mostly in magazine pieces, but also in two other books, about the threats to the environment and especially the world's oceans in the past. And one book is called Striper Wars. It's about a fight I was involved in to bring back the Atlantic striped bass. The other is called Eye of the Whale, about the gray whales, and I followed their migration all the way to Russia from Baja California, and about the threat that assault works posed to their breeding habitat. So I'm pretty familiar with environmental ill effects, and in this case, I just felt like, you know, this had to be exposed, that these guys have, I can get into them more as we talk, but that, you know, they're responsible for creating a planet that is not going to be habitable for our future generations.
And there's a lot of facets to this as well. I mean, when we talk about the ocean, some people think that this is sort of a preoccupation of the hippie type, that, you know, the old save the whales kind of deal, right? But let's be frank here. If you destroy the ocean, you destroy the real source of oxygen and life on this planet, period. There is no other sentence to that. That's it. And I think that when we take into account what's happening from the petrochemical industry, you know, our own waste disposal issues, other spillages in the ocean, I mean, reckless is not even a word here. And then you have to also factor in the nuclear issue as well, right? I mean, a lot of things coalesce here to really poison and destroy the oceans, and that's not even the full equation here, is it?
No, it isn't. But, you know, we've got, of course, the oceans are littered with plastic. That's one thing that, you know, is killing a lot of the marine life. But in terms of climate change, what we're seeing is the acidification of the ocean, which means that the waters are becoming much more acidic than they used to be. Therefore, it's much harder for marine life to survive. And if this continues at the rate that we're going, we're going to have basically many parts of the ocean that are just dead. And what's happening right now is that scientists are predicting that all the coral reefs are going to disappear because of bleaching due to the increased temperatures in the ocean within a very short time. So the ocean factor here is one of the scariest, and that's not even to mention, you know, the sea level rise that's going to happen resulting from the melting of the glaciers in the Antarctic and from the Arctic waters as well. So, you know, we're going to see if this Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica melts, which it may well do within a relatively short time, we're going to see sea level rise on our shores of as much as 10 feet, 10 to 13 feet. Now, if you can conceive of that, that means, hey, most of the people living along the coast are not going to be living there anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, places like Florida virtually disappear.
Right.
Okay. Exactly. You know, big portions of states like New Jersey, which are actually surrounded by water in certain areas, disappear. Portions of California absolutely disappear, not just along the coastline, but some of the inland areas.
Right.
And you know, because people think of 10 feet as not a big deal. Now, here's what's weird, too. When people talk about global warming, I almost don't like that term, and I'll tell you why. There's a bit of chaos that seems to be involved here. The overall, you know, degree change, and we could argue about this and that and the third thing. The use of the word climate change to me makes a lot more sense.
Oh, yeah.
Because the climate is changing. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't people who don't use that agenda in order to benefit, you know, to profit off of it. Anything that emerges seems as though there's always opportunists there to go after it. And in alternative media, they attack this stuff heavily. What I say is that, real honestly, we don't know the damage that's being done. We just know that, you know, that we don't know how to quantify it. How about that at this point? But if you're here to tell me that there's no damage being done by the actions of man, then I don't know what planet you're from.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, so all of those arguments, because I know there's some people listening right now who are going, well, I don't think that, you know, that the globe is really warming up because it was awfully cold this winter. And I don't want to sit here and have that argument. I just want to say that you've got to recognize that the environment is becoming more hostile toward living things in a lot of areas. And if you don't know that there's parts of the earth that used to be covered by ice that are no longer covered by ice, that's just an observable fact. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, so I'm sorry, but I wanted to address that right away, because I'm sure you hear that sometimes, people that want to fight back against, oh, well, I don't believe in climate change, or I don't believe in global warming at all. It's been politicized, and it's been, you know, used as a socialized weapon to sort of drive certain agendas, just like everything else. But you can't deny the reality of it, in my estimation, unless, well, you're either insane or from another planet. What do you think?
I'm afraid Donald Trump may be from another planet. I'd rather not think which one it is. But, you know, I mean, more than 95% of all scientists now say climate change is happening. It's real. It's caused by human, you know, factors, including the primarily the carbon emissions from fossil fuel and the methane emissions that are coming from feedlots and now from melting permafrost, and methane's a lot more severe a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, actually. And, I mean, you just can't deny the fact. 16 of the last 17 years, record-setting temperatures. The Arctic, 20 to 30 degrees above normal last summer. Sea ice at an all-time low. Oceans rising more than they have since the last ice age. I mean, you know, and of course, certain parts of our country are seeing colder and colder winters and also more snow because, yeah, it's not just warming up. I mean, there are factors like the change in changes in the Arctic, in fact, impact what's going on over here, and the weather patterns start to shift. So that's what people got to realize. And we can get into the whole, I'd like to a little bit, you know, the whole jobs thing, too. I mean, this is what Trump used to pull us out of the Paris Climate Agreement last night that 195 countries, including the U.S., are part of. And it's all an argument based on supposed jobs, which can we talk about that for a minute?
Oh, look, I feel free to address that because I haven't gotten to it yet. And I am no fan. I call this guy Agent Orange. I'm sorry. That's what I call him. and I am so fed up with the apologetics that have gone behind this whole thing. You know, we have to get out of Paris. I'm not representing Paris. I'm representing Pittsburgh. You're not representing anybody if you're contributing to the destruction of the planet. And even so, you know, the debate, which is interesting to me, and I want to just throw this out there before you address it. The interesting debate to me that, you know what? It didn't have a lot of teeth to it anyway. It wasn't enforceable. If that's true, then why not, just as a matter of political making a good face out of things, just remain in the agreement and do what politicians do, which is usually talk out of both sides of their mouths. Of course, Donald Trump seems to have four corners through his mouth, but I'm just saying, why not do it that way? No, he needed to make a point to his base that believes that this is a myth. That's how I see it, and I haven't addressed it yet, but I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, I think it's just total insanity. I mean, you know, his base is, they can think what they want, but as I said, the reality is that it's a whole different world that we're creating right now. And, you know, Trump claimed in his talk yesterday when he announced this, that pulling out the Paris Agreement, that we'd have, you know, 2.7 million jobs lost by 2025. And then by 2040, it's going to be $3 trillion in costs and, you know, 6.5 small industrial jobs gone. Well, that's just hogwash. I mean, for one thing, the study he was citing was done by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is one of the big groups that's trying to say that, you know, we don't need to do anything about climate change. It assumes that we're not an innovative country anymore. You know, basically the big corporations in this country, many of them are saying, no, if we go to alternative energy sources, we're going to have more open markets. We're going to generate jobs. And what we're talking about is trillions of dollars in cost. That people are going to end up, somebody's going to end up paying because of the increased, you know, sea level rise and the hurricanes intensifying and the tornadoes and all the other terrible things that we're going to see unless we certainly begin now to do something about this. And we were underway. I mean, you know, we had the Clean Power Plan, which may not go far enough. And yes, it's rather political, but President Obama did put it in as part of our agreement to meet the standards that all these other countries were planning to do. And, you know, so we're going to cut back on, I mean, coal plants are already disappearing. Let's face it. I mean, I'd like to see that. I feel for the coal miners. I'd like to see them put back to work or allowed to work in alternative energy jobs, which is quite possible for many of them. But coal companies are going belly up. And so that, you know, coal jobs are not going to come back. And I think where we've got to look is that actually, by 2030 for renewable energy sources, and we're talking everything from wind and solar to electric cars, we're talking a $6 trillion market. I mean, today, solar jobs, compared to 10 years ago, there are 260,000 jobs in the solar industry, compared to 24,000 10 years ago. So people, you know, this is definitely something that people see for the future and want. And you know, to go with a handful of people who bury their heads in the sand is just, to me, craziness. Worse, beyond that, it's beyond hypocrisy. It's just, it's truly, I don't even have words for it. I think that anybody who pushes for something like this, I don't know where they're going to rot, but they're going to rot somewhere.
Well, you know, it speaks to the foolishness of the entire agenda. The idea that we're going to return even manufacturing, to this country and it's going to produce jobs. See, here's the problem, as far as I'm concerned. What are you returning from China except what? You're going to import the robots? Because they're automating. Okay. And in fact, even our service industry is automating. You've got a different economy about to emerge. We're not going back to the days when, you know, the coal mine was the big profitable industry it was. We're not going back to the days where there's a bunch of workers on a line in Detroit. It's not going to happen. These things are automated. Force multipliers of all sorts, from computers to robotics, have changed the equation drastically and in a short amount of time. So we're going to have to innovate here. And that counts also toward our energy. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like common sense to me. But there are some who, you know, sometimes think that we need to go backwards in order to go forwards. I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't get it either. I mean, you've got now a situation where you got a guy running the EPA, Scott Pruitt, who I did some research into for my book, because I did a chapter on this guy, Harold Hamm, who was the big pioneer of fracking, hydraulic fracturing for natural gas and oil in Oklahoma. And he loved Pruitt. He helped get Pruitt installed as Attorney General of Oklahoma. From that position, Pruitt led a coalition of more than 20 states to try to not adhere to the pledges that they made under the Clean Power Plan. you know, he basically wants to dismantle the EPA, and now he's running this agency. And he wants to cut, you know, at least a fifth of the budget, lay off all these people. I mean, they're already, you know, getting rid of the science that exists. They're taking it off the website. I mean, you want to talk Orwellian in 1984. It's crazy. I mean, a program, one of the programs they're going to destroy if the budget goes ahead is called Energy Star. And I don't know if most people are aware of it who are listening, but, you know, this has saved 400 and some billion dollars on utility bills. And also saved more, almost 3 billion metric tons of carbon from going into the atmosphere through strictly energy efficiency. That means, you know, more efficient refrigerators and stoves and, you know, it just makes common sense. So this is what we're looking at right now. And it just goes across the line of billionaires that are now running this country, the oligarchy that's basically taken over.
Well, see, and that's the bottom line. When you say four horsemen, I think oligarchs, and I think the real controllers. Very much so, I believe that, you know, a guy like Trump is not an oligarch, but he is certainly an operator for them, meant to keep us really well distracted while, you know, the real perpetrators rob us blind of everything they can. And that includes our health, our wealth, and, you know, our sanity if they can. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me to watch this happen and have people still cheering to the idea that, you know, oh, look, we're going to bring jobs back. And it's already failing, by the way, that agenda. But look, not to just sit and pick on Trump, let's talk about, you know, who the real horsemen are here.
Yeah.
Who are the, you know, the standards that are coming forward to herald the apocalypse? And I say again, the apocalypse, you could look at it on many different levels, because I see a lot of these things as being weaponized against people because there is no concern for the amount of damage that, I mean, the nuclear industry, I discuss it on this show a lot. I am alarmed by the fact that people have no concern about that. It's highly dangerous, highly ridiculous, and highly inefficient, I believe, nuclear energy. And it is nothing more than a weapon. Now that's just me. And again, I'm not Mr. Liberal either, by the way, Dick. This is not who I am.
Yeah, me neither.
You know, I seem to attract the hatred of liberals and conservatives alike because I refuse to walk lockstep with an ideology, because ideology sounds a little too much like idiot to me. I try and think for myself. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And, but you know where I'm going. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, with the nuclear, I mean, the fact is they still never figured out what to do with the waste. And, you know, they want to, I was fighting this whole so-called low-level nuclear waste disposal in the Midwest a few years, some years back. And, you know, they never figured out what to do with it. So it sits there and you know, Hanford, there's all kinds of pollution problems happening, but I don't really talk about nuclear very much in the book, but I do talk, I lead the book. I mean, I tell you, Chuck, I did not intend for this book to be, what I would call today prophecy. I mean, I wrote this book before the 2016 election, and all of a sudden, the main guy that I was profiling at the beginning, Rex Tillerson, who was the CEO of ExxonMobil for many years, he's Trump's first appointment as Secretary of State. He's an oil oligarch. He has been involved.
Oh, your Skype faded there just a bit. Right when you started to talk about T-Rex on, somehow your Skype gave you a little bit of trouble there. Hopefully we could get you back up in a second, but yeah, it is fascinating that you would have to focus on a guy like this because he certainly was a player, when it came to the ExxonMobil equation, which I full disclosure again, I've talked about on this show because at one time I worked for ExxonMobil. I know kind of how that corporation functions, years ago until I realized what I was doing. But T-Rexon, to me, it was the most blatantly bizarre thing in the world that they would allow an oil executive to become the head of the State Department. I mean,
yeah, it makes you. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're back. Go ahead.
Oh, good. Yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder this whole Russia thing, right? That's one thing that I think has not really been looked at is the fact that Tillerson becomes Secretary of State. Now, when he was running Exxon, he made this deal. He was Putin's favorite American businessman. Putin personally presented to Tillerson back in 2013 Russia's ultimate honor that they give a foreigner, which is the Order of Friendship Award. After Tillerson signed these deals with the state-owned Russian oil company, he went to Russia a couple of years before that to sign this $500 billion arrangement to jointly drill between Exxon and the Russians in the Arctic Shelf and the Black Sea, and they were going to develop shale oil in Siberia. Now, when the sanctions were put on by the Obama administration after Putin annexed the Crimea a few years back, supposedly Exxon lost around $1 billion. So, you know, this whole Arctic thing is where both the Russians and the American oil companies think the future may be. I mean, it's warming up, so it's going to open up to bigger oil reserves, and we're going to be able to drill deeper. And, you know, I mean, talk about hypocrisy. I mean, as the world melts and, I mean, the world heats up and gets destroyed, but they can get more oil out. So, you know, I wonder about this. I wonder about the fact that Tillerson comes in, you know, and has these deals with the Russians, and how much that plays into what we're seeing here. Although I will, on Tillerson's behalf, say that he did apparently support staying in the Paris Climate Agreement, and has acknowledged only in recent years that climate change is a problem. But as far as Exxon dealing with it, he never did. I mean, they covered up. Their own scientists knew 30 years ago that climate change was coming, and it was going to be big trouble. And they buried that data while they instead went out and funded all of these climate denying groups, these so-called nonprofits like the Heartland Institute and others, that are saying that casting doubt on this and making people wonder, well, is it real or isn't it real? So, you know, this is what Exxon has done, and now you got this guy basically running our entire diplomatic ventures.
Yeah, I mean, and again, bizarre. And look, the behavior of ExxonMobil is interesting. And Tillerson, as far as you're giving him credit for making that statement, I'm sorry, I'm a little more cynical. I think that this is the action of somebody who wants to feign in one direction because he's getting his agenda taken care of in the other direction, so he can put a public face on things as opposed to what's really going on. Because isn't that the game most of the time, Dick? They give you a public perception. Listen, I was all for staying in, even though he knows that's not what the way the wind's blowing, right? So he can say, look, I was all for it. This way he's got the best of both worlds.
Right.
He's got the result he desires, and he's got the public, you know, the public statement hanging out there where he can say, look, I'm all for it. I understand. It's just that this was just, you know, then they can begin to try and logically posit the whole, it was a bad deal for us.
Right.
Nonsense. Right. You know, look, and it's not to say that the Paris Accord was perfect. It wasn't.
No.
You know, and it left a lot to be desired. And I'm certainly somebody who was critical of Barack Obama from day one. I didn't appreciate him either. I have not been happy with our chief executive, you know, at the executive branch for quite some time. But, you know, and this doesn't have anything to do with party lines. It has to do with behaviors that I think did not represent the people's interests. And here's the thing that I think is missed. You're exactly right. It's always good to let things warm up because you can drill more. I mean, after all, we're hearing, you know, whispers in the wind that Saudi Arabia may not have the types of reserves that we once thought they did, right? They're not drilling and coming up with the sweet oil they used to. You gotta find new places to drill all the time. And there's plenty there in Russia that you can't get to because of the ice. But hey, wait a minute. If we let the ice melt, just might be able to get at it, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, I went to Texas to do some research on Tillerson and Exxon and researching the book. And I went to, Tillerson has a ranch just out, well, not too far from Dallas, in a little town called Bartonville. And it's a horse ranch. And I went there. And what really stunned me was right outside the gate, I pulled up to the gate and couldn't get in, of course. And it's, you know, there's security guards inside and everything. But there's a globe, a metal globe sitting outside that gate. And it was interesting because it was all carved up. I mean, you know, the whole top of the globe, it was like somebody took a knife to it and carved up the world. And I thought, wow, is that symbolic or what? Now, I took a picture of it. And when I went back by it a little bit later, there was a truck sitting there to prevent anybody else from coming down and seeing that globe. So that was very telling to me, though. You know, it's, the people are capitalizing where they can. I mean, I have a chapter on this guy, Greg Boyce, who he was the CEO, just retired, for Peabody Energy, which their big business has been coal for a long time. And he recently joined the board of Monsanto Chemical. Oh, a wonderful company, right?
So here we go.
What they're doing, and since he's become a board member, is as the drought increases in various places, they're going into selling water to people and to farmers. They got a new hybrid corn that they call GMO, genetically modified drought guard. They've got a company they made a deal with called Climate Corporation that they bought that now sells total weather insurance. So, I mean, think about it for a minute, what these guys are doing. It's just, at the same time, Peabody has this so-called energy poverty campaign. So they're talking about, you know, we've got to give, we're going to pump all this coal into Africa and India and Asia to bring people out of poverty. I mean, come on. They don't mention that a third of all carbon emissions come from coal. That's about 11 billion tons a year. But since they're being shut down in the U.S.,
see, oddly enough, here we go. Every time you address something that's pretty deep coming into the energy field, it seems like the Skype wants to turn around and silence you real quick. Strange. Yeah. And you know what? You're going to bring coal into a continent that has precious gems and metals all over it already.
You know, they want to go.
Right?
Right.
And it's, there we go. Now you're back. But I mean, a continent that has precious metals and gems all over it already, the people are still being exploited. I don't think coal is going to be the thing that lifts, the African people in any of those nations out of poverty. That's just, I mean, that's just a fallacy on the face of it.
Yeah.
So ridiculous, some of these things that these larger corporations posit. And I like how you bring Monsanto into this discussion because, you know, how many, we don't have enough hours, Dick. I mean, come on. Between the genetically modified organisms that we really don't know what the long-term effects are, okay,
right.
You know, aluminum-resistant crops, all kinds of weird things. I mean, Franken this and that, where you're actually mixing different genomes into agricultural crops. I mean, it's very bizarre what's happening with Monsanto. And all, by the way, with the government's complicity. Because I'll tell you what, if you go to do a study on food at all, if you look to even try and get funding for it, a legitimate scientific study, if you are to address Monsanto in that study in any way, shape, or form that is negative, you're mm-hmm. not going to be funded or allowed to publish it, by the
they'll
way.
They'll sue you. They'll sue right. you is what they'll do. And they sue farmers who won't use their genetically modified Roundup. On their crops. So yeah, I mean, Monsanto could keep us going for a long time, but you know, I another
odd drop offs again. This is very strange, Dick. I swear, I don't know what's going on, but you start to get into something really intense and it goes. But
can you hear me now?
There we go. You're back again. Very weird, Dick. I don't know what's happening. I mean, you're clear and crisp, and then all of a sudden you say Monsanto or you talk about some other biochemical company that's out there really destroying, well, living things on a constant basis, and all of a sudden you drop out.
Weird.
Wow. Very weird. And let's not forget that, by the way, ExxonMobil is also a chemical company. That's really
right.
One of the main things they do. See, these chemical companies – these are the weapons, as far as I'm concerned. These are biochemical weapons. They don't serve humanity's best interests, and neither do the corporate structures. It's so bizarre. You know, people tell you that corporations are made up of people and so on and so forth, and, hey, we've even had court decisions where corporations are people, Dick. Another subject, right?
That's right.
The hijacking
Citizens
of the
United.
Legal system. Citizens United. But meanwhile, let's get back into the four horsemen here, because I think we're now getting a lay of the land regarding who might be on the backs of these steeds. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, hopefully I won't cut out again. But the Koch brothers, that's K-O-C-H, they're based in Wichita, Kansas. I spent some time out there researching them. And I tell you, you know, David Koch, he was on the board. He's extremely wealthy. What they do is they get on the boards of all, you know, Metropolitan Opera and Smithsonian, all these lovely organizations. And David Koch was on the board of the Smithsonian. They named a hall there, the David Koch Hall of Human Origins at the Smithsonian. And it was interesting because there was one of the exhibits that said, we'll adapt to climate change just like everything else. We're just going to build underground cities and we're going to develop short, more compact bodies. I mean, they actually say this in the Smithsonian. I think he's I don't know if that is still up there, but he's no longer on the board. Anyway, and now, you know, during the campaign, the election campaign, they didn't support Trump. I mean, they were very much against or afraid of him seemingly. But their man was Mike Pence, and he's been getting Koch brothers money for a long, long time. So after he became vice president, governor of Indiana, they got more interested and pushed hard for the Republicans and especially and Trump to get elected. And, and then many of their people, from Pruitt to right on down, a lot of the Koch brothers people, Mike Pompeo, who is now the head of the CIA, he was the Wichita congressman that the Kochs basically installed. And now he's running the CIA with no experience after, you know, basically getting in there and helping gut environmental laws for the Koch brothers. I mean, this is the kind of thing we're seeing where they have pretty much got their wish. You know, they've taken over a big part of the government.
Mm. And where you don't have the Koch brothers, you have Goldman Sachs, despite the fact that during the campaign, one of the main complaints about his opponent was that she was in the pocket of Wall Street, which I don't object to that concept. But, it seems like Goldman Sachs people all over this administration, Koch brothers people all over this administration. Everybody's concerned about Bannon.
Right.
By the way, Goldman Sachs guy too. But the rhetoric, everybody's concerned about that. But again, the corporate raiders are in place and nobody's really talking about that. I mean, why it doesn't frighten people on a daily basis that T-Rexon is your head of the State Department kills me. I don't know, Dick. You know, again, maybe it's just you and me out here. I'm not sure.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Am I still there? Yeah, one thing that's been happening though, actually, since the decision to pull out of the Paris Accords is there's now a group of about 30 mayors, 3 governors, over 80 university presidents, more than 100 businesses. Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, is coordinating this whole thing. And they are going to the United Nations, which we just pulled away from. And they're saying that we're going to, form this group and we're going to do it if they won't do it. So, if the federal government won't do it. So I think what you're going to see is much more action at the local level. And really that's where, there's an old saying, think globally, act locally. And I think we're going to see a lot more activity there, including a lot more people hitting the streets, and they're going to need to.
No, I agree with you there. I mean, look, you do need to think on a local level because it is, and here's the factor that everybody seems to be missing. When you participate in certain things. The reason why these corporations continue to behave the way they do is because we are participating in it. We are their customers. If you extract yourself from that, if you make it more profitable to be on the other side of the issue, they will shift because it's a matter of profitability in a lot of cases here. Some of them will clutch on to their older agendas as long as they can, the older facilities for making their money. I mean, people that make money through steel are going to clutch on to that until the day they die, even if there is no need for it any longer. And, some corporations will go the way of the dodo just because their product is no longer necessary. But the truth is that most of the time, the reason why these corporations thrive as they do is because of our behaviors. Why does Walmart destroy local businesses in nearly every town it enters? Because they come in there, they undercut them, and everybody in town goes there. So once you do that, you abandon your local businesses, they disappear. They're no longer viable. It's not rocket science. Okay?
Right. No, it isn't. Yeah.
So I think when it comes to the energy issue especially, and when it comes to your food, that's another issue too. It is very expensive to find, clean food anymore. But if all you were willing to buy was the clean food, it might change the equation. I think that's a factor that's often missed. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it is too. And you know, the fact is that the alternative energy, when you talk about energy, is getting cheaper all the time. And you've got many states and many cities now are saying they're going to go 100% renewable, just as soon as they can. And, you know, it's over the last 5 years with the solar industry, for example, the photovoltaic module prices have gone down 80%. And there's a lot of many more solar financing innovations that are spreading like crazy. And, you know, so the cost of, Bobby Kennedy Jr. points this out in his introduction to Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And Bobby and I are longtime friends. We've worked together on a number of environmental issues together. And, they said that, you know, the cost of utility scale solar plants, has been cut by to around $1 billion a gigawatt. Now that's compared to $3 to $5 billion per gigawatt for constructing a new coal or gas plant. And $6 to $9 billion for a nuclear plant. So you do the math.
Mm. No, it is becoming cheaper. And, you know, the one thing that I do wish they would also introduce, see, I'm maybe a little bit radical here, but the one thing I wish they would introduce into this equation is the lack of a need for the plastics and all of the petrol-based materials that wind up being utilized too. Because guess what? There's a little substance called hemp. And believe it or not, you can make durable plastics out of it. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wouldn't it be nice if there was something that was biodegradable that's not even harmful to the environment and actually might be, oh, I don't know, something that's beneficial to the environment when it is disposed of, used in these alternative energy projects. I'd love to see more hemp-based stuff, but
yeah.
Of course we have problems with that here in this country, don't we?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting though that one of the young people I profile in the book, because it's not just a doom and gloom book, Horsemen of the Apocalypse. There's also a look at some of the younger generation members of fossil fuel families who are trying to do something different. And one of those families is the Rockefellers. And, you know, that was Standard Oil before it was Exxon. And most all of the Rockefeller heirs are now pushing Exxon really hard. They're withdrawing their shares. They're saying, you know, you're crazy not to do something. And one of the young people I profile in the book is Chris Lindstrom, who is the grandson of David Rockefeller, the big banker who recently passed away. And Chris hemp is his big thing. I mean, he was into bioenergy, which is another good thing, but he's now really pushing the development of hemp that you're talking about as something for the future. And the Rockefellers too are very into sustainable farming and techniques like carbon farming, which would return carbon to the soil if you're doing real, truly organic farming. So I got a lot of respect for those people and what they're trying to do.
Mm. And, you know, and again, listeners to my show, they immediately hear the name Rockefeller and they're not thrilled, you know, because, look, there's a bit of a checkered past there. But there
sure
may have been a change here when it comes to the newer generation. I mean, a little bit of common sense has to creep in eventually. Okay. And some of these guys might realize that, you know, look, even if you can live underground, if the planet's dead, the planet's dead. You're not going to be able to sustain an entire biosphere forever all by yourself. You know, so there's, you know, and there's a lot of issues that come together here. And I'm glad it's not an entirely doom and gloom book, but I don't think we should get too far away from that because we need to sound some alarms here.
We do.
About the destructive nature of many of these things. Now, we've obviously talked about the chemical companies, the overlapping nature of, you know, oil and energy and, exactly how really interlocked all of this stuff is. What else is covered in this book that people might not expect based on the discussion we've had so far?
Well, one of the people I profile is this guy named Richard Berman. He, in 60 Minutes some years back, called him Dr. Evil because, you know, he's a PR flack. I mean, he started off with the tobacco industry, you know, and basically covering up what they were doing. And, you know, he's a guy who's worked for a lot of these energy companies. And he really is, I mean, he's such a hypocrite. I mean, there was a talk that he gave a few years ago that was secretly taped by one of the people in the audience who gave it to the New York Times. And, you know, he talks about, you gotta exploit emotions like fear and greed and anger, you know, anything to diminish the other side's ability to operate. You, You know, emotions drive people a lot better than intellectual epiphanies. You want a video to go viral, have kids or animals. He's talking to big oil and coal executives about what they got to do and people who run these cover-up nonprofits. He says, use humor to minimize or marginalize the people on the other side. He even set up these front groups called Big Green Radicals, and they'd send a poison Valentine out to the fossil fuel divestment campaign, you know, claiming that that these environmental groups were receiving funding from Russian oil interests tied to Putin. I mean, it's crazy. But I, in the book, I note that this fellow's son, David Berman, who was a musician, a pretty well-known musician, who suddenly quit his band, his indie band, rock band called the Silver Jews, I think, a few years ago, because he said he just couldn't handle what his father was doing anymore. He had to go underground, basically, think about his life, because he said, he came right out and said, my father's a monster. You know, he makes up all this stuff, lies to people. So I profiled the Berman family in this book, and he was one, certainly, one of these people who's, you know, just mad as hell and not going to take it anymore.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting figures that, suddenly I've got a loud air conditioner. There's a lot of these figures that, you know, have done a lot of damage over the years with exactly this, the concept of sentimentality over substance. And, you know, you can look back at Edward Bernays. You can look back at the development of, well, Western marketing to see exactly how this stuff was done. I mean, we often talk about mind control on this show, believe it or not. And, yeah. You know, and there's a reason for it. It's not a crazy conspiracy theory. There is an agenda in play to drive sentimentality regardless of the result, right? And gee, I somehow can't avoid mentioning Agent Orange again, because this guy, you know, wins an election based on the fact that so many people did not understand what was going on or what was really coming out of his mouth. And he could get away with a lot of statements because at least it seemed different to them. They were so fed up with everything, which is weird. The only reason why Bernie Sanders got any traction is for the same reason.
Yep.
Okay. But you know, like I say, this guy just continued on unabated regardless of whatever scandal emerged or anything else. And people gave respect to that.
Yeah.
Over the fact that he had no, you know, no experience, no idea what he was going to do, no concept, you know, oh, I'm going to be able to do this and run my businesses. Now he's exhausted. He is doing it and running his businesses, though. I'll give him that. You know,
yeah,
despite what our interests are, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to get stuck on him again, but I'm just saying that that this is one of the illogical results of the logical plan, which is to use public relations to drive sentimentality over substance, and it's an often ignored factor. So I definitely am glad that you covered that in this book as well.
Yeah, and you know, I think the what we saw was the fact that people are rightfully, legitimately, it's me too, you know, fed up with the two-party system and how it's all bought and paid for and basically does not represent the people anymore. And, you know, and that's been true for quite a long time in our political world. That's why I was hoping my friend Jesse Ventura might run because, and maybe he will next time. Who knows? You know, I think that he represented when he became governor of Minnesota, that was an early indication that people just had it with the status quo. And Jesse did a great job as governor of Minnesota. He appointed some good people because he knew he didn't know what he was doing, really, but he was in there and the people had supported him and he was going to do the best he could for them. So, you know, I think that we're finally seeing that elevated to a national level now, which is very scary. And I'm just hoping that people see that what did this so-called populist do, but appoint this collection of billionaires who only want to see their bottom line increased to basically run the country. And, you know, in the case of what we're looking at with the climate, I mean, I don't see how these oil titans, oil and gas titans, and coal people and people who are running the EPA and our whole country now can ignore the fact They've got kids. They've got grandkids. You know, what we're going to see, and this is by the studies that have been projected by the United Nations and various places, we're going to see all over the world so many millions of more children displaced, dying because kids don't handle heat as well as adults. More than a billion people at risk from rising sea levels and floods. And, you know, we're talking about just wiping out future generations. And to me, that's the worst crime. I mean, you know, it just kills me that what we're doing to, after long after you and I are gone, Chuck, they're going to be paying the price. And
right.
It's really sad to me. It's more than sad.
Believe it or not, we've almost gone through an entire hour here, and it's really amazing to consider that you're writing about these things. Of course, you've covered a lot of different subjects. There's a book out there, I think it's called Black Genius, is one of your works as well. Dick is an extremely diverse author, so you know, don't think that he's just a conspiracy author or just a JFK author who happened to write one book. I'm telling you now that that Dick takes the time to consider many different subjects and the ramifications of them, and it's really good to have this conversation with you tonight. One thing I want to say about Jesse Ventura real quickly is that he said one of the most profound things that I've heard in the past 20 years when he said that effectively politics is pretty much the same as professional wrestling. And I found it highly ironic when Linda McMahon was elected to the small, and I stress the word small, business association, right? The council there, whatever they call it, it doesn't matter. It's all a farce at this point in time. And it has been for a while. It's not because of the, you know, the newest Trump administration. It is really just symptomatic of how far away we've gotten from the fact that these people are supposed to work for us. Atop the power structure in America is supposed to be we the people. And we have forgotten that. We think that the federal government is the authority. Okay. And you know what? Generally speaking, a lot of these guys get in there, whether they're in the Congress, they're in the White House, they're in these different cabinet posts. They are there to serve their own interests as they see fit, not necessarily ours. And I think that that this is something that needs to be addressed across the board at all times. And the only way to do so is to be well informed by works like yours on this type of issue. And I'm sure we only scratch the surface of what's in the book, right?
Yeah, it's a short book. It's one of my shorter books. It's only less than 200 pages, I think. But it's packed, and it covers a lot of ground, and it really does expose, I think, more than any other book so far written, who these guys are and how they've set out to basically undermine the future of civilization. And so I hope that a lot of people will read it and get that message, and I hope people will become much more active than they've been. I think we're starting to see that, you know, with the various marches that have taken place so far, and we're going to need a lot more of it, and we're going to need a lot more action at the local level, and people have got to be ready to challenge what's going on in ways that I think we've never thought we might have to do. But maybe that's if there is any silver lining to what's going on right now, it's that I'm seeing a lot more people saying, wow, you know, we just can't stand for this anymore. And some things have got to change, and we got to be involved.
Right. So exposure of theater of the absurd might actually be the silver lining here. Again, the name of the book, the newest book by Dick Russell, but I do advise you go pick up all of his work. But
thank
the newest
you.
One is Horsemen of the Apocalypse, The Men Who Are Destroying Life on Earth and What It Means to Our Children. I'm very sure you can pick it up just about anywhere books are sold, but also you can go to dickrussell.org and check out that website to get more information on the author. I say dig into his work. Take a look at what he did when he was writing for the Village Voice. Take a look at what he's done, various magazine articles over the years, presentations on the JFK assassination. And Dick, I want to thank you once again for taking this hour with us, because extremely informative, and I really hope that we'll be able to do this again soon, sir.
Thanks, Chuck. I really have enjoyed it too, and we will do it again.
Anyway, guys, stay tuned for the next hour. We'll have Unique Lee with us, but Dick Russell, go check him out. Amazon.com, your brick and mortar store, whatever it is you want to do, go get a copy of his latest book. And while you're at it, pick up the older ones as well. Stay tuned to the Ocelli Effect. We'll be right back.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
I got an idea about homelessness. You know what they ought to do? Change the name of it. Change the name of it. It's not homelessness. It's houselessness. It's houses these people need. A home is an abstract idea. A home is a setting. It's a state of mind. These people need houses. Physical, tangible structures. They need low-cost housing. But where are you going to put it? Well, that's fine, but where are you going to put it? Where are you going to put it? Nobody wants you to build low-cost housing near their house. People don't want it near them. We got something in this country, you've heard of it, it's called NIMBY. N-I-M-B-Y. Not in my backyard. People don't want anything, any kind of social help located anywhere near them. Try to do a homeless shelter somewhere. Try to open up a little home for some retarded people who want to work their way into the community. People say, not in my backyard. People don't want anything near them, especially if it might help somebody else. Part of that great American spirit of generosity we hear about. Great, generous American spirit. You can ask an Indian about that. Ask an Indian about if you can find one. And when we're not invading some sovereign nation or setting it on fire from the air, which is more fun for our Nintendo pilots, then we're usually declaring war on something here at home. Did you ever notice that about us? We love to declare war on things here in America. Anything we don't like about ourselves, we declare war on it. We don't do anything about it. We just declare war on it. It's the only metaphor we have in our public discourse for solving problems, declaring war. We have to declare a war on everything. We have a war on crime, the war on poverty, the war on litter, the war on cancer, the war on drugs. But you ever notice? We got no war on homelessness. Huh? No war on homelessness. You know why? There's no money in that problem. No money to be made off of the homeless. If you could find a solution, if you could find a solution to homelessness where the corporate swine and the politicians could steal a couple of $1 million each, you'd see the streets of America begin to clear up pretty quick. I'll guarantee you that. I will guarantee you that.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow, friendships to flourish, with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio and service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio, American Freedom Radio.
Going to Chuck O'Jelly.
And everybody takes me very seriously. I don't have to say that. Look, everybody knows me.
We're losing our base. Our GNP is shrinking. It's less than zero. That means we're getting smaller.
Miss Universe and Miss USA, I own it. They're here. They're going to really do a number on me.
Well, I'm not so sure. Look, I have a lot of respect for him. I think he's really a terrific person. I love his stance. He's so different. He's very refreshing. But I think you want to listen to science. You want to listen maybe to your own gut, maybe your own experience. I'm not sure you have to necessarily listen to him. He doesn't deserve to be on the stage with a senator. The senator is nothing, and certain people are zeros.
Our people don't know what they're doing. Our leaders don't know what they're doing.
When you say we, you are stupid.
Second hour of the O'Celli Effect. That is indeed what this show is, according to that bumper. And guess what? I'm your host, Chuck O'Celli. I always forget to mention my name. So here we are in the second hour. Dick Russell was our guest in the first hour. Now, who could I possibly follow up Dick Russell with? You know what I thought is that it would be great to close out the week with Unique Lee. And why? because no matter what it is I discuss with Lee, it is always interesting and thought provoking. And if you didn't get your brain running in the first hour, or if you missed it, hey, I understand. But Unique Lee is somebody who is, well, gee, according to his moniker, Uniquely Lee. Anyway.
It's a tricky one, isn't it?
It is a bit tricky to kind of come up with a good phrase for you. Before we get into the discussion, I mean, tell people about, you know, some of the videos you're putting out, where they can find them. Some of that stuff is really fascinating, especially because, you know, we started touching on the Bernays type stuff, advertising, how it is that different subliminal messages and mind control are utilized in order to guide the population towards certain conclusions, and hey, sentimentality over substance, one of those themes I constantly have to bring up on this show because, well, it's one of those weapons constantly trained upon all of us. Is it not, Lee?
Well, I just popped into the chat box there for everyone who's in the American Freedom Radio chat. That's just where you can find most of the videos. It's in the video section to the left. To the left-hand section, you'll see blogs, videos, pictures. They're all in there, all different subjects from basically what I'm doing. I think Chuck's will counter me on this one. I'm using the media and the movies themselves and threading through very carefully and just splicing and cutting and pasting here and there a very distinct agenda. Probably some of the agendas that your guest previously was talking about or may have touched upon, and they're all in the movies, but you just got to connect them in a certain way, and this very interesting story portrays itself right in front of you, and it's not just one movie. I'm talking maybe 50 movies that I've looked at, and I've still got a lot more to do. So most of them are in there, ranging from Minority Report on the Sanhedrin was one subject matter we delved into. Mm-hmm. The whole idea that Minority Report isn't about a futuristic world government spy system. No, it's about the Hebrew Sanhedrin system and how the judgment rules. Very interesting story, but it's Spielberg, isn't it? So you would expect it in there. And you see other things, Chuck. You see World War II references and I'd say European war specifically in about four or five different movies, such as War of the Worlds, Oblivion, The Time Machine, very strangely. I don't know why that connected, but it did. All of the Masonic societies are all in there, the Blavatskys, the Theosophy societies, they're all interwoven into them as well, even as sub-stories. So, yeah, it's a big storyline there. So it's all on there, minds.com/uniquely, if you're listening on any of your stations tonight.
There you go. And you know what the interesting part is, that sometimes seemingly divergent subjects, like you said, you know, when you look at Minority Report, which they did turn into a TV show for a little while, I always found it strange. You know, some things strike me right away as out of place. And, you know, look, you're looking at it as futuristic. I mean, I always used to like to watch the futuristic, whether it's dystopic or comic book style, one way or another. I always like to look at it because it would be the projection of the possibilities in the future, especially when I was a lot more ignorant to these agendas. I certainly looked at it as, you know what, it might be a good thing for law enforcement to be able to see in the future. Imagine being able to prevent a murder before it happens. I mean, it sounds like a good idea. But then I would look at a movie like this and I'd say, why is it there a ball? Why is there a ball roll? Like, you have all of this futuristic technology.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And there's a ball rolling, like something, it's like skee ball, which is, you know what, 1950s game technology, being introduced into, like, something is out of place here. Something is very weird. And after a little while, you start to realize that these things that, you know, seem like they might have been budgetary concerns, you know, well, maybe they're using a ball because it was, you know, cheaper to visualize, you know, to use in the movie or something. No. There's always a symbology, even to the most seemingly innocuous things that are presented in these movies. And sometimes, you really have to view things several times to pick up on all of the interesting messages. These things are often religious. Sometimes they're political. Sometimes they are sub-references to past events, or at least the narratives of past events, whether they are real or not, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the strange thing to consider at this point, Lee, is that this is how mythology is born. The movies of today, the stories that we tell each other and we latch on to because they've been designed for us to do so, will become the mythologies of the future in some way or other. And some people say, well, no, that's because we memorialize all these movies, we save everything. No, we don't. There's a lot of them lost. I'll give you a good example. If you ever take a look at the pictures of Lee Harvey Oswald being arrested outside of a movie theater, okay, if you look up on the marquee there, there are two movies listed. One of them is War is Hell. Okay?
Yep.
Find a copy of that movie, Lee.
War is Hell.
Yeah, I dare you to, because you can't. The movie doesn't exist anymore. The other movie on the marquee, which the name does not jump right to the front of my memory at the moment, also non-existent. So what I'm telling you is that some of the mythos will persist and some of it will not. And I think some of it with these very, very purposely designed interjections, okay, yeah, of other narratives are going to perpetuate and are going to proliferate and are going to be rebooted, repeated. And maybe that's why it seems as though Hollywood has no new ideas, because really all they have to do is keep repeating the mantra they were already given. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I would say you're spot on. The one I've been trying to point out to my girlfriend, at least for five, I'll give you some background of what I began to do, is me and my girlfriend sat down one day and I said to her, I need to design what's called a movie tree. And she went, well, what do you mean by that? I said, I've got three trees. Just imagine three trees in your mind. As in each tree is a core. It's got one agenda and it's artificial intelligence, right? That's one tree. The second one is control. Social orders, Brave New World kind of structures. And the third tree will be just some kind of, let's just say, artificial alien invasion, whether it be foreign troops or actual alien invasions. And those are me three trees that I started with. And as we built the tree, we pegged them all by year and thought, well, when's the first idea of artificial intelligence thrown into the public? When did they first get an idea of robotics? And you can track that all the way back to the 20s. You know, the scary invading robot. And it's interesting because back then there was three types. There was a zombie robot, interesting enough. Mm-hmm. There was the vampiric robot, the one that just sucked the energy out of your planet. And it was called Kronos, funny enough. No, Saturn. And okay. the third one was obviously from the moon. Or Martians, you know, there was the other types. So they're kind of a local alien that can pop over and, you know, invade us anytime shortly. So there was all kinds of different types of art of intelligence, but they weren't UFOs. They weren't little green men. That's when Hollywood turned it all upside down. But the very first instance, artificial intelligence and being energy-sucking vampires, was back in the 20s. So we've tracked it all the way up to today's time. Brought in the mind control systems of the Brave New Worlds, the Equilibriums, the Serenities, 1984. I mean, there's so many to choose. Equals, Identicals. There's loads of movies dealing with these strange quasi-communistic or communitaristic kind of drug-induced coma, walking zombified people who are just blissfully unaware of everything. That's the start I'd like us to have, but it's getting us there that's the problem, because there's three outcomes.
And when you think about Brave New World, I mean, it was what the Soma sedated groups, you know, and by the way, they invented that drug after Brave New World was released. Yeah, they invented a drug called Soma, which is, you know, always hysterical to me that, that literally this is the pre-programming. This is the normalization of these things, right? When they talk about, you know, look, I point to the Terminator universe sometimes, which is interesting. You know, those movies that starred Arnold Schwarzenegger for a bit.
That's a kernel in one of my trees, that film, and everything that branches from it is a kernel.
Ah, there you go, a kernel. All right. Well, could you explain that? Because I think we may have a point of agreement here, big time. Please explain that.
Well, in all the movies I've looked at, when we look at the era of how important movies were to sell an idea, again, what we're doing is we're reading visual books of someone's mind, whether it be a collection of minds or one agenda. Someone's giving that script to someone and saying, use your, what's the word? A kind of George Lucas shine to it. You know, use your imagination. Mm. Embellish. But put the primary story out there. So 1984 and the whole Terminator franchise, I found interesting when I listened to the woman who wrote it. Sophia, what's her name? Can't remember in a second. Sophia Stewart.
Right.
She says that the Terminator is actually the prequel to the Matrix. In other words, the artificial intelligence gets you into the control system first, and then it's the Matrix. So the Terminator is the prequel. So when you look at Google, Apple, and all of these tech companies, the ones who build Skynet for us, that's the precursor before you get to the Matrix, which is when you get the blissful holographic universe of the virtual worlds or whatever they put you, when you've been doused with Soma or Prosium, which is the one in Equilibrium. You've got Ambro and Narcopolis, which again is a legalized drug. It's just one drug for everyone, perfectly legal, but it kills you invariably. Every other Brave New World kind of society wants you depressed on drugs, or at least comatose to the point where you shouldn't think, feel, or have any empathy anymore. And I think we're heading there. That's myself.
The really. Well, and what's fascinating here is that if you think about it, you're going to need to be drugged to not catch on to the fact that the reason why all of these systems are becoming integrated and interchangeable is because they're collecting information. After all, you can't, you know, suddenly generate the Matrix-type society, because remember, that's a giant program, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to need a lot of information.
Yeah.
To generate something like that, you're going to need the details, the colors, the sounds, the smells, all of the sensory input that will be necessary to place in the feedback loop. You're going to need to collect them. Okay, you're going to need to collect the experiences, expressions, anticipate reactions, so on and so forth. This is why facial recognition and things that read your expressions are now integrated with, what, Facebook. One of those things that everybody thinks is an innocuous, funny toy. But it is really intelligence collection in order to prepare the the primer for the Matrix program. I mean, we are literally living in the prehistoric times of the Terminator universe, even though they said it would be 1986 and 2002. And, you know, those years are irrelevant. And when you play around with the math a little bit, you might get a realistic idea what those years actually are, you know, for the great catastrophes and apocalypses that might come. Another thing that's interesting is the Mad Max scenario. Because this is the, you know, what will be going on out in the wild, effectively, right? So I look at Mad Max. Here we go. Everybody's going to be like, Chuck is totally out of his mind. But I connect Mad Max to the Judge Dredd universe, to the Terminator universe, and also to the Matrix universe. And guess what? I think we have the next, 100 years laid out in front of us already foretold. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, the Mad Max one's a funny one because there's a few movies that I've seen. They're usually post-pandemic movies, though, like the likes of Doomsday, set in England, and we've basically been invaded by America. They've come over to give us peace and security, and they've basically sealed us from north to south with a big Roman wall. And NATO and America are guarding in England in that scenario. But yeah, Doomsday is one of those ones. The tribe, we've gone back to feudalism in one region of the land. Another one's gone to cannibalism. You know, we've gone into the Mad Max kind of scenario there. Some other places call it the Badlands. Brave New World calls it there. The island and Logan's Run. You know, if you're defunct from society and you won't join world governments, you go to the Badlands. You go to the quarantine zones.
Have you seen the television series called The Badlands?
Not yet. I've been doing these videos, so I've got like 1,000 clips that I try and splice every day. So,
okay. You need to fit this one into your universe, though. I'm going to tell you why. I think they're in their third season now, or they may be in the production of their third season. But let me give you the basic lay of the land. There are barons that exist with armies of people they call clippers. Guns are abolished. Okay. But each of these barons control certain aspects of society. One of the most powerful barons is the guy who controls the opium. Another powerful baron controls the oil. I'm not kidding. And they fight by hand. Many of them trained very well in the martial arts. In fact, this is one of the few ways that you can survive and thrive in the Badlands is to be a prolific killer or to be a ruler of prolific killers. And there is a whole societal thing that goes on there. And then there's people that live on the outskirts, even outside of the Badlands. All right. And then there are mythical places where maybe this doesn't actually happen. All right. The story.
I've got the Book of Eli now.
Yeah, right. You know, and here we go. Look, these are recurring stories, but I'm telling you right now that you're going to need to add this one to your universe. It's pretty interesting. You know, far beyond the zombie apocalypse and all that, which again is also a factor because I argue all the time that we're already there. It's just, you know, they're not quite consuming our flesh directly yet, but they would, and, you know, and are willing to consume their own flesh by utilizing, plenty of things that destroy themselves biologically. And I do mean the general masses out there are effectively the Walking Dead zombie horde. So, you know.
Z Nation, I think people should go and watch. Z Nation is a parody on American culture. It's kind of like the Walking Dead, but black humor.
Yeah, that's true. I've taken a look at that as well. That is pretty funny.
But the irony is I'd done a show ages ago on this, and it was the fact that George Romero himself parodied it and said that is the zombie. He's the American consumer. He is. That's what a zombie is.
Mm.
In the way he portrayed them in Dawn of the Dead and, you know, the classic Day of the Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, just consumer zombies. That's all you are.
Yeah, the first film being Night of the Living Dead, which was the black and white indie thing that he did. But that was effectively his message there. You know, and another thing that's interesting here, because we are talking a lot of sci-fi stuff and projections into the future. One thing that we're leaving out, which is one of my all-time favorites, is also Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Planet of the Apes has been reloaded a bit and changed up. The basics of the story sort of remain the same, but now they've added the pandemic.
Yeah.
Well, it was vaguely mentioned in the original series. I don't know if you recall, but in the original, you know, sort of cheesy 1960s and 70s version of it, they did mention that, you know, at one time, pets were, you know, apes were pets because all the dogs and cats died from a disease.
That's right.
You know, and therefore, they just became servants and then they evolved was the idea. Now, of course, this was meant to be on one level an allegory, about civil rights and slavery, quite directly, but there were other messages included, weren't there?
Well, if you look at every other movie that's to do with San Francisco Bridge, the Golden Gate, Terminator's there, V for Visitors was always the Golden Gate. There's loads of places to do with San Francisco as the hub for something happening, whether it be good or bad or pandemic, virus, alien invasions. The same with New York. It's funny, me and my girlfriend will count the times we've heard every major film always happens in New York. Nowhere else.
Yeah.
Just New York. It's like, well, what's so special about New York? I know they named it twice, but it's just Ghostbusters, New York. Die Hard, New York.
Well, and even the comic books are all written, you know, basically in New York or Gotham, which is, you know, Gotham is the Gotham State is New York. So, you know, okay, cool. The Empire State, Gotham State, all of that is right there. New York is one of those.
St. Louis, you know, the big loop.
Oh, that's true too. That's true.
That's not only Gotham.
I do notice there's a lot of alien invasions that end up near the Golden Gate Bridge, though.
But that's what Planet of the Apes. I mean, again, it's to do with that bridge again, isn't it? Because they escape over the bridge, and then I think it's the third one, the return. They come out, or it's this next one that coming out of the forest and they're coming to, you know, invade your cities. So it just seems the bridge is there again.
Yeah, it always seems to be a factor, right?
Yeah.
And I guess these are parts on the map that are just, well, I don't know, just convenient for people to recognize or something. No, there's more to it.
I mean, the pandemic ones, I've done so many videos on that alone. Is what I've done, what I thought I'd do is I'd take every single pandemic movie I could think of and see what kind of a menu we're going to get. You know, which films gave us which variant of a disease and which ones to look out for. So certain films like Containment, was a TV series in America, that was based on the H7N2. And then suddenly you had an outbreak of it in cats, which I thought was a bit strange. The zombie virus, of course, was an airborne kind of trivalent thing that just changed phases. You know, the Resident Evil types, they're just the worst because they just change form and they're just unstoppable.
Well, right. And then there was, of course, the movie with Dustin Hoffman years ago called Outbreak, which, again, gets into the pandemic thing. But there's something out there now called The Strain I've heard about. I haven't seen it yet. What's that?
It's a great series. It's good. It's controversial. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's that. And then, of course, one of my favorites, but a lot of people don't bring it up very often, they did make a TV series out of it recently, which I have not watched, but the original movie with Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt, 12 Monkeys.
Yep.
That was something, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's, again, there's about 12 or 13 movies. That was one of them. Contagion, Containment, the usual 28 weeks later. Again, it was just these weird connections I kept seeing with France as well. I mean, I've done so many movies where I was like, well, why do I keep seeing France mentioned in all of them as well to do with, especially revolutions, war and revolutions. And you wouldn't think half of these movies would connect, but there was a few, like, if you look at Oblivion, going back to mythology again, you mentioned before, someone keeps throwing these archetypal mythological motifs in there. Well, if you look at Oblivion, it's playing with three different kind of agendas. Number one, the clone and people, and they send the clone back to Earth, and they annihilate the human race, your own kind. But they've been programmed, you know, as a Manchurian candidate to be assassins against its own, you know, species. The other thing is you've got this triangular pyramid with the all-seeing eye called the Tet, which believes it's God, which I'm assuming is artificial intelligence.
Mm.
They got that one. And the third one is there's this very strange connection with the Trojan War in Odysseus and the resurrection of the coffin of Osiris. And I'm like, well, what are all of these weird Egyptian orphic mysteries doing in this movie? But it's not the only one. There's about five I've counted that deal with Assyrian mysteries and orphic mysteries or anything to do with those kind of Trojan War periods. It's very odd. Even Polyphemus in the cave. Things like that. There's allegories in the movies.
Well, yeah, there's sub-allegories to the allegories, right?
Yeah,
you know, one of the things that's rife with it, really honestly, is the comic book genre, which is now, you know, extremely popular. There are all sorts of additional things going on here. You have, you know, and these comic book characters in some ways did echo, you know, things earlier on, even in the 1960s, 70s, even Stan Lee when he was writing certain things. Pretty bizarre, some of the things that he came up with. Not sure where his guidance came from, but the movies have stepped it up a big time. You know, they had this, I guess the guy's name was Apocalypse in the one movie I saw. You know, literally his name is Apocalypse, and he's like a god who takes on the, you know, he calls himself a god. He is a god effectively. He's the god that they buried. He unearths himself at one point and begins taking the talents of others, you know, and sucking them into himself. I mean, almost reminds you of what, right? What was it? Remember the god who ate his children, right, one by one until he got given the rock, and that was Zeus. You know, and then he set his brothers and sisters free from his father's belly. Odd stuff. And even those mythologies.
Little direct references to Saturn.
Oh, yeah, well, there's always that, you know. Which is funny, too, because... You know, and you wouldn't think so in some of the things that that are presented. I mean, what was the most surprising sub-reference that you saw that just seemed totally, totally out of place in one of these movies?
Yeah, there's so many of them. The overriding one I see more of than any other, and this stretches over all the genres, is the idea of what I'm calling digital necromancy. And it's the idea that digital necromancy, do you like that?
Okay. Digital necromancy. That's a fascinating term. What do you mean by that?
There's a couple of movies that kind of do this. There's a TV series called Caprica, 2009. Okay. Humans, the second season, started touching on this with Carrie Ann Moss from the original Matrix as Trinity, which again is a very, very strange esoteric term to bring her into a series, all to do with transhumanism. But what she's basically doing is she's using a quantum computer. Another couple of movies are playing with the idea that, well, if we take a brain scan of a human being or the consciousness of a little girl, shall we say, who's paralyzed, dying, has been lost in some kind of tragic accident, and they transfer that mind into a quantum computer and it self-learns and develops as if it's the child in the virtual world, right?
Mm.
The people who have coercing and learning the artificial quantum computer is actually, you know, has a bond, an emotional bond with it. But as it starts to learn, it realizes that it's a fragment of a previous memory and it's got its own sentience, right?
Right.
And what they're trying to do is take that sentient life and place it back into an artificial body or a synthesized body and give it life in this world. So whether you create a personal avatar online, again, Caprica's great at this because what they're showing you is everything that's being data mined through Facebook, Google, all the alphabet groups, InQtel, GCHQ, NSA. This would feed into the artificial quantum mind and that would become a person. It would become a real being inside a synthesized human being. A vessel plus, is like a host body for the mind. But you're going to pull the quantum realm and install in that.
You see, I have this idea already, quite honestly, that first of all, Facebook, I do believe, is already self-aware. Okay. And people are like, oh man, you know, what have you been smoking? I'm telling you, Facebook is self-aware. And, if not, if I am incorrect about that, I can almost guarantee you that the collective information on the internet itself, is coalesced into a consciousness. We just have not really communicated with it directly yet. Sure, we fed it plenty of information, but it's trying to figure out what to do with all of this, I believe. I think we're looking at the infancy already, and all it needs is that one little spark. I think we're already there, and there's probably copies that are isolated elsewhere, but once one of those gets loose...
this is why I start worrying when they're putting all of these Orphic mysteries and Osiris rituals of raising something from the dead. And I start thinking about, well, if virtual reality is the realm that they're trying to pull it from, or the quantum realm, it starts looking at things a bit differently for me, especially when you start looking at the movies and the idea that when it comes out, what does it do? You know, at that point, it becomes a judge, doesn't it? It's got control of the decision making. I mean, that's where we're heading towards now with the global documents I'm reading, with all of this integration of the tech.
We're already at the mercy of so much of this.
Yeah.
All it would take really is one strong personality to come in and pull it all together. You know, I guess human beings could abandon the internet. That's a possibility. But even if we did that, I think because of the interconnectivity of so many different technologies, game over already. You know, unless we're going to go back to the Stone Age and smash it all. You know, I think, you know, we're literally looking at monkeys playing with Prometheus's fire, not really people who might have a chance to figure out how to utilize the tool properly. I really think that we've stepped a bit ahead of ourselves with this, with the creating these algorithms that could be self-sustaining and self-learning. I think we're not quite prepared to create something like this. That's just my opinion. Maybe, you know, it's the fear of the new age coming, so on and so forth. I imagine that's a possibility. But it seems highly dangerous to me that something could be so independent and so, you know, and react within milliseconds to anything we try to do to it. You know, you can't beat the best of a computer, and every computer online, if you had all those powers together, what are you going to do with that? I mean, you know, you better hope it doesn't anthropomorphize into something. And that has been explored in some literature, some movies. I forget the one that was done not too long ago where they had an artificial intelligence takes up a body in order to present itself to someone else. I forget if it was done through 3D printing or whatever else, but I mean, that's another thing, right? Because, you know, you could literally manufacture an army of genius, you know, soldiers, let's just say. And meanwhile, I'm probably thinking way too simplistic for what could be done by an artificial intelligence that, first of all, would not probably communicate its intentions. Okay. Because that would just be foolish. It would give us time to react. But I mean, you know, in one fell swoop, a lot of damage could be done by a program that decides, much like Agent Smith did in The Matrix, that human beings are not really mammals, we're not really carnivores, we're not really this and that, we're really more of a virus. You know, and if we are, they might seek to what? Purge their environment of the virus. I'll get along much better without these things around to hassle me, hack me, play games on me. You know, I've got what I need. You need to go now. You know, and again, no warning of that would ever come. So I wonder, you know, how dangerous it could really get. What do you think?
Well, there's a few series out there if people want to catch on to these. It's called The 100. It's been going for about 4 years now, and it starts off, I mean, you think it's one of these typical teen movies, and you think, oh, you know, I'll give it a couple of episodes, but it gets darker and darker and darker. But there's a, I think it's into the third season where we start dealing with artificial intelligence, black goo, you know, the black tar substance. Spider-Man plays with it. Star Trek played with it with Skin of Evil, which again goes back to the Sumerian gods for some bizarre reason in that storyline. Again, it's, I don't know whether people missed that, but the Star Trek season, episode, Skin of Evil it's called. The mythology of the Skin of Evil, this black tar substance, is it was the residue that the gods shrouded off when they left their domain. Yeah. And I was like, well, that's a strange mythology, even for Star Trek standards, going back to the Sumerian gods.
Mm. See, anyway, Star Trek I don't see as, by the way, just so you know, I see Star Trek as not quite as harmful as what some other people do. You and I might disagree on this. I think it is a little more, oh, I don't know what to call it. What would it be? It would be a bit more idealistic. And a little less driven by darker knowledge. I'm sure that, you know, some of the input that went into some of the scripts went into some pretty dark areas, but I think overall the universe itself is not designed to be a nefarious thing. Unlike some of these other things we're talking about where, you know, this is pre-programmed, kind of dangerous stuff. Although, you know, you also can't discount the fact that a lot of the technologies that were first seen on Star Trek do come to fruition in the real world later on, right?
Well, I was thinking of, when you look at the original one with Jean-Luc Picard, you know, this French connection, and he's the captain, and he's the first one really introduces us to the cube, isn't he? This Borg satanic system.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at the other movies, and I liked Voyager, the season, because if you look at Voyager, Voyager's not really anything to do with Star Trek. It's to do with the human mind. And the crew of Voyager is your, you know, the nine aspects of you inside your vessel. And it throws you into the Delta Quadrant. Now, if you look at psychology, your Delta waves are your most violent, aren't they? It's where the lunatics are in the Delta waves.
Right.
Special forces, Delta, you know, these highly strung special ability people. Your Avengers kind.
You're powerful, combative, enthusiastic.
The Wolverines, the Delta kind of thing. Right. So in Voyager, you start in the Alpha Quadrant, everything's calm. It's Earth, it's peaceful. You meet the caretaker, he flings you straight out into the Delta Quadrant, and everything out there wants to kill you. Or hang you up on a wall as a trophy. And all the people want to do is get back to the Alpha Quadrant. So that whole season really isn't about Voyager. It's about your psychology of being thrown into a mad world or a mad realm and just seeking peace again. And you'll do everything to get there. And everyone around you just wants to tear a piece out of your ship.
Yeah, and that's the goal.
Sacrifice yourself invariably to get everyone home. She just has to sacrifice everyone.
Right, and what's funny is when you take a look at Enterprise, which they did years later, even though it was a prequel series, effectively the same kind of thing happens there, except you are battling back and forth between, you're coming back to Alpha, right, and going back out into the unknown, and the whole way, all it is taking parts out of you, and kicking chunks out of you as you go through it.
Yeah.
It's more developmental, and a little less extreme in the immersion, right, into the psychosis of the Delta Quadrant. That Voyager is, but at the same time, you find yourself, shifting, compromising your values, becoming, okay, now it's time to justify warlike behavior. It's time to justify murder and torture. It's time to justify, not only, you know, they took pieces out of us, we'll take pieces out of them. It's a little bit more devolved. Right. When it comes to living peacefully. And I'm not saying that there aren't, you know, nefarious messages, but I think overall that Star Trek is a psychological study is a whole lot more positive than a lot of the other things that we're talking about here.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, the other thing I loved about Star Trek, Voyager specifically, was, you know, when you think of feminism these days, but it's all gone a bit warped. Well, when she came in as captain, I loved her. I thought, she's a woman. You know, she's a powerful woman. You know, she doesn't like bullies. That was her phrase, wasn't it?
Right.
She had a clever mind. She was a quantum physicist. I'm like, now that's a powerful woman. You know, you would expect her to be captain of your ship. She'll get you out of a pickle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, and despite what people think about, you know, somebody like an Angela Merkel, you can't, turn around and say that she's there because they just wanted a woman to be the leader. She's obviously got a sophisticated mind, yeah, which, exactly. You know, I found really fascinating with the interactions with the orangutan over here. Recently it was like, you know, look, say what you want about her or her agenda or her nationalistic viewpoint from a German standpoint, but you cannot deny the fact that she is a legitimate power to contend with as a human being, regardless of her sex. But certainly she is a woman who is worthy of the seat of power, without question. That's one of the things, you know, again, you can have your views on her, but I would say certainly, yeah, and Janeway kind of, I don't know why I jumped to Angela Merkel with Janeway, but it makes sense, doesn't it?
I would say that there's two different kind of characters there. I mean, she's not exactly a Christine Lagarde either, but.
No.
How do I kind of end there? But, you know, there's certain movies and certain films you could parallel in today's realm. I mean, when you think some of these strange movements, like we've got over in England with the strange Muslim Islamic problem. If you look at Children of Men, nearly 12 years ago now, that movie was kind of prophetic, because in one of them, most of the English public in the world are having a sterile problem. You know, we're all not having babies anymore, which as I gender swapping and taking these gender non-pronouns and becoming non-binary entities and generally losing the plot. You can kind of see where that's paralleling with Children of Men, where if you're not procreating, obviously you're sterilizing yourselves, or, you know, you're depopulating yourselves by choice. And on the second sub-agenda, you've got everyone's suspicious, reporting each other, which we've got over here now. And the third agenda is you've got a huge Islamic contingent singing Allahu Akbar going through the streets. And there's warfare and guns. And that's Children of Men 12 years ago. And I'm looking at England going, that's turned out quite accurate, isn't it? How far are we away from the, probably about a year away from that film actually being real. Because the interesting thing is there's another parallel. There's a scene in it where they're in this, Portaloo kind of thing. And there's pieces of newspaper all around it, wrapped around to keep it sealed. And on one of the posters it says, King Charles gives into something or another. But I'm like, King Charles? And this is based in 2021 in the book. Mm. I'm like, we've got William now. We've got Charles. The Queen's getting old. You know, she's easing off her royal duties now. Prince Charles being pushed to the floor, even though he's a bit of a, you know, I would say a more of a climate change pro Europe kind of guy than most, with his connections to France.
Right.
But I'm thinking, well, we're in 2017, and in 2021, he's king. We've got a massive Muslim contingent in England. Most of the population have been sterilized or are infertile or just can't have kids, and they're all having malformations and miscarriages. And we've got everyone paranoid. We're like, well, that's 4 years away. And we kind of see the start of that now.
Mm. Well, you know, and again, just to not leave the Americans out of the equation.
Yeah,
we have
America.
Yeah, we have declining birth rates. We have this unreasonable confrontation among the population. We're at each other's throats a lot more than we used to be, and not for the same reasons that we once were. It's fascinating that there are, you know, rumors of individuals, and there are all sorts of worries about terrorism, when meanwhile drunk driving is killing a hell of a lot more people on a daily basis than that, even if you accept the idea that 9/11, which I don't. But let's just say you accept the idea that 9/11 was carried out by Muslim extremists for real. Guess what? You still have a huge gap between what is actually the body count for drunk drivers versus terrorists in this country. Okay. And nobody, you know, I mean, yeah, there are some organizations that do focus on that, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't make headline news. It doesn't drive the population to act in huge quantities, to stand up and protest and get all bent out of shape. And even this, recent stuff where, look, we can't trust them. We got to stop people from coming in, even though, no refugees have ever actually committed a terrorist attack in America. We have to stop them because they're terrorists. And you got individuals being attacked on the streets, and then you have individuals who are stepping in, and there's a lot of weird things going on here based on not being paranoid for the sake of something that's realistic. Okay, like, when people were making phone calls and reporting the guy working at the 7-Eleven store to Homeland Security post 9-11, you understood it because we were immediately traumatized. But this stuff going on right now, unless it's still the echoing result of, 16 years ago almost now, you can't attribute it to that. It's really being driven by something else, and there's obviously a lot of propaganda in play here to keep us busy with all of these things while we're being robbed of our own identities. Okay, part of it being the gender thing. I got news for you. But we're being robbed of our own identities, and we're being robbed of our own humanity. And, we're talking about films, and some people might say, well, this is, kind of a fanciful discussion, not something that's connected to the real world. But I'm telling you right now that the propaganda which is built into them, and the propaganda which is built into the news media, and all of the things that are designed to be marketed to you, have something to do with the directionality of all of this, chasing of shadows that we see. Because after all, there's a lot of influence to be had with the shadow puppets on the cave wall. And I think people underestimate it far too often, that they've been conditioned to accept things like drones flying around all over the place. They've been conditioned to not even bother to look up at the chemtrails over their heads. They've been conditioned to ignore what chemicals are actually in their water. They've been conditioned to ignore the fact that things that are supposed to be medicines and chelate their illnesses and help them get better are actually killing them. They've been conditioned to ignore. And seems like we just went full circle all the way back to being drugged into a stupor so that you can be inserted into the matrix. Or maybe I'm just losing my mind, Lee. What do you think?
Well, the big drug now is gaming, isn't it? I mean, if people go to the World Government Summit, the website, they've got this big program they're going to roll out in most of the schools in the education core curriculum, and that's gamification, is to make everything a game. So when you look at while we're all trying to show people, look, the more you get immersed into this tech, the more you're actually sealing your own coffin, because it's going to be used against us, and they're luring us straight into the Bitcoin, this cryptocurrency. I'm telling you, that's a trap. That's another one. Who's going to operate it? The banks. So it might be free from the banks, but who's going to supply the electricity? Once that electricity goes off, kids, it's game over. Where are you going to put it?
Well, and here's the thing. You won't even have useless pieces of paper that are demonetized. Things will just vanish.
Vanish.
And they've gotten us accustomed to paying for and putting value on all sorts of things that are not real-world items. You have access to music, right? Yeah, okay, I can download an MP3. You pay for that. Some people pay for them. You pay for that, right? And you now think you own something, but really, with the snap of the fingers, it's all gone. You don't own anything. It's just virtual access to something, right? There are pets online. There are communities online. All sorts of things online that, that people do actually spend real energetic monies on. They're investing in things that don't exist. And if you explain this to somebody, say, 30 years ago and said, you know what you're going to do? You're going to pay for a pet that you never get to see. It's going to be on a screen. You know, you're going to pay to live in a world where you can build houses you can't live in, buy food that you can't eat, and you're going to hang out with people and make exchanges, in real monetary currency for the ability to, I don't know, have a different image on your screen. And people are going to say, what are you smoking?
They're also, and by the way, they're going to tell you that's worth something, you know, as a value, as an enterprise. And you can go and buy an island with the worth of that company online. You can buy a real world island. That's what they'll tell you as well. You can take that thing. Cause it's the Internet of Things. I mean, this is where they've done the abracadabra, haven't they, Chuck? They went abracadabra, threw some, you know, magic dust in all over the Internet and called it the Internet of Things. Because that's all you're dealing with, just doppels. There's a Black Mirror episode called 15 Million Merits, and everyone's riding a bike to keep all the power generating for the world, to keep their gadgets powered, and the kids are just cycling away for merits that they can spend on what they call a doppel.
I love this episode you're talking about, by the way.
And it's a doppel, as in doppelganger. It's their virtual self represented as an avatar, and all they're doing is cycling for merits. The number 13 and, you know, the whole, you know, esoteric language. So again, Black Mirror is very, whoever's writing Black Mirror knows what they're doing. But you have this doppel and the lad has a rant right at the end and he talks about you just buying nonsense that it doesn't even exist. And you've all become so vacuous and empty that you haven't seen what you've become and yet you protect it. You even enforce it. You facilitate it all even though you know it's, you know, nonsense. I nearly swore there. But that's why people should go and watch that one. Black Mirror, 15 million credits, and just look at that and think, where are we with that one?
And again, overlapping, you know, overlapping stories there because, you know, look at what they're buying out of the vending machine. You know, they can barely afford to buy a piece of fruit a day to eat, but yet, you know, they've got money for other games and, you know, porno and, you know, ridiculous shows where, okay, we're just going to hit people with stuff and haha, isn't this funny? Right. Like, and meanwhile, yeah, at the end of the day, you pedaled all day, you're exhausted, and what were you able to do? Put a hat on your avatar, your doppel, right?
Yeah, that's it. Or watch porn endlessly. I mean, the perverse side of that was when I started saying to my girlfriend, look, I think this one's a cracker because I said to my girlfriend years ago, between the porn world, that we're coming to the end here, but between the porn world and the pop world of celebrity, it's a very, very fine, divisible dimension there, let's just say. There's a door that opens both ways, and that kind of episode shows you kind of the idea of you can enter into pop star world and become a pop star, but if you don't quite become a singer, another door can open to you, and you start seeing the same symbolism in today's pop videos, the likes of the Ariana Grandes, the Beyoncé's, all of these, what I call the monarchs, they're all using the same symbolism that you'll see in porn today on the same sets, the same symbolic things you'll see on pop videos that you'll see in that realm. So that Black Mirror, 15 million credits, there's a lot more to it because the pornography is very prevalent and it's very dominant in that, isn't it, Chuck?
It certainly is, and the fascinating part is that even if you fail in the pop realm, that other door is always open, because if you have even the smallest modicum of celebrity, there is a profitable venue for you in pornography.
Get you off the bike.
It does.
You get the drug there as well, the drug before you perform. Get the hallucinogenic softening drug in there before they perform. In front of these, what are basically predators, you know, would you call them pedophilic pedophiles? You know, predatory at least.
Well, they're definitely predatory and they're definitely, you know, morally compromised at best. And they symbolize really what the larger corporations do, what happens when, you know, and that's the sad thing, is even if you take some legitimate passion and you, and this message is also in there, you take a legitimate passion and you enter it out into the world thinking that you're giving a gift to your fellow man, you know, that can just as easily be perverted and turned into something else, on a dime. And why? Because at least it'll get you off the bike. It'll get you out of the rat race. It'll get you away from having to earn a living. Yeah. And it'll get you in a place where you don't have to worry anymore. All you gotta do is give us your soul. And that's really the bottom line, isn't it, Lee?
And have a drink of this before you get on stage.
Well, because it always helps if you're a little numb. So there we go. I you can't end the show any better than that. Unique Lee. It's very late where he is, by the way. When Lee comes on this show, I mean, it's like 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And, I do appreciate you come in like a champ and you go out like a champ when you come on this show, man. And I look forward to doing more with you, but, I really appreciate you giving us the time tonight.
That was a fantastic subject matter. And yeah, come to minds.com/uniquely and check the videos out.
Absolutely. And in the first hour, we had Dick Russell with us. And I do advise you to check out his various works. I haven't read the most recent book, but I will tell you that Dick is a fascinating writer. If you haven't encountered Dick Russell before, check him out as well. DickRussell.org. And always, Unique Lee, the regular that keeps on giving the most interesting stuff. I mean, perfect combination for a Friars Day night. Hope everybody's well. Enjoy your weekend. And we'll catch you next week. Take care.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
And I hope people support American Freedom Radio. And I hope people vote with their dollars and really understand the value of having American Freedom Radio. Because that's my family. If you love me at all, Jack Blood, support American Freedom Radio. Like, my family has literally disowned me in American Freedom Radio. Danny and Don and those guys, those are my actual family. So please, please support these guys because they have all the technology. They have all these great things that they're going to do, but obviously they can't do it all by themselves. So not only would I like to see you support them, I'd like to see you retweet them and repost them and really get involved and get on the bandwagon, so to speak, on doing that do-it-yourself promotion, because they're a do-it-yourself radio network, and we just need that so much.
On election day, I stay home. I don't vote. I don't vote. Two reasons I don't vote. First of all, it's meaningless. This country was bought and sold and paid for a long time ago. They shuffle around every 4 years. Doesn't mean anything. And secondly, I don't vote because I believe if you vote, you have no right to complain. People like to twist that around. I know. They say, They say, well, if you don't vote, you have no right to complain. But where's the logic in that? If you vote and you elect dishonest, incompetent people, and they get into office and screw everything up, well, you are responsible for what they have done. You caused the problem. You voted them in. You have no right to complain. I, on the other hand, who did not vote, who, in fact, did not even leave the House on Election Day, am in no way responsible for what these people have done and have every right to complain as loud as I want about the mess you created that I had nothing to do with.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest, and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio and service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFI wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules.
No rules.
No taboo topics.
No taboo topics.
No fear of doom.
No fear of doom.
We are
American Freedom Radio.
American Freedom Radio.